special legends and lessons are always special. But tonight we get to talk about the Maharal of Prague. Very interesting that we call him the Maharal of Prague, because as we'll see, he didn't really spend a lot of time in Prague. But first, let's thank our sponsors tonight, Jerry and Sandy Begel, for their finishing, and Esti and Jose Gomez, Rabbi Gomez, for their finishing of the Rambam Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, which is a big undertaking. And we thank them for their sponsorship. And Emir Hashem, they should continue learning. Kein Yirbu, as we say, continue learning. Okay. The Maharal. What does Maharal stand for? Morenu Harav Luria. No, that would be the Arizal. But both of them don't have their first names. They only have their last names. The Maharal is Morenu Harav Loi. Or Luio. There's a whole conversation about how to pronounce his last name. But either way, his first name is Yehuda, also known as Yehuda Leib. And there's actually a Rabbi Yehuda Loi in Farber, in Akiva, which is always interesting. I asked him if he was related. He said no. But either way, Rabbi Yehuda Loi. And a lot of his life is a little murky in terms of why he went to different places at different times. There are a lot of different suggestions as to why he did. But to start us off, he was born in 1512, maybe 1511. And he was born to a rabbinic family. His father, Rav Betzalel Loi, was a Rav, and he had learned by the Maharshal, who was a Luria, Rav Shlomo Luria. And basically, so that puts us basically in Ashkenaz. And Rabbi, and the Maharal himself was born in Posen in Germany. But they make their way to Poland. Maybe he was born in Poland, I don't remember. But his father was a Rav, and his three other brothers were Rabbanim. So his brothers actually, I listened today to Rev Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb, people who know him from the OU, so he actually claimed that his brother was more famous during their lifetime than the Maharal was, which is kind of an interesting statement. But he says that Reb Chaim, who was the chief rabbi of Worms, we know the chief rabbi of Worms was once upon a time Rashi himself. The Maharal says, like Rashi, that he was actually a descendant of David HaMelech. So it would be sort of in the family chain to be the rabbi of Worms. So his older brother, Reb Chaim, his next older brother is Rabbi Sinai, not a name that we're familiar with today, but Sinai. And then Reb Shimshon was the chief rabbi of Kremenitz. Rabbi Sinai was the rabbi of Nikolsburg and Moravia, which the Maharal ends up going to also. So all three of his brothers were also rabbis. In their own right, very significant rabbis. And then, perhaps the most famous nowadays is the Maharal. It used to be that the Maharal was Reb Chaim's brother. Now Reb Chaim is the Maharal's brother. Interesting how that works out. But we'll get to understanding that later. Posen is in Poland, so that's why I mixed up there. He was born on the first night of Pesach. And interestingly enough, they say that there's a legend that goes along with his birth, which is that apparently when his mother was ready to give birth, they were looking for a midwife, and they ran out into the streets to go find a midwife. And it just so happens, just at that time, there was someone trying to stage a blood libel. A person was carrying a dead baby and was going to plant it inside of a Jewish home, right? It's Pesach time. There, you know, all those stories where they say the blood libels with the blood and the matzah. So apparently while the people were running out to get a midwife to deliver the Maharal, this person thought they were chasing after him, and it just so happens that he started running away, and then they assumed that he was suspect of something. They found out what he was doing, and then it led to imprisoning that person and saving the Jewish people for a lot of heartache. That's the legend of the birth of the Maharal. So he was born into legend, whether because of his brothers and their rabbinic status, or because of his own salvation of the Jewish people, even in utero, the way that worked. Either way, he was obviously a genius as a child. Unclear where he actually learned. He was in Posen, so there are plenty of rabbis there. Ultimately, he gets engaged to a girl named Pearl, P-E-R-L, maybe Perla. Not really sure if they changed, if the name got sort of, you know, diluted into English when it got, you know, transferred over. But either way, she was the daughter of a rich businessman. But as you can already, you know, as you can already intuit from the story we just said, at the time the Jewish people weren't doing too well with their neighbors, at least specifically in this town. Overall, the Jews were actually in pretty good shape with non-Jews at the time. But at this specific place, so the non-Jews were out to get his future father-in-law. He was engaged to this girl Pearl, and this guy was a wealthy man. And as it so happens, his father-in-law, whose name was Shmelka, was committing because he was wealthy. He said, "I'm going to support the Maharal." Turns out that his house was broken into. It was looted, and then it was burnt down. So for the time being, the Maharal didn't have any support to get married, right? The plan was that his father-in-law was going to support him. He was going to get married to Pearl, and he was going to be able to learn. He was going to be able to further his studies, and ultimately he lost his support system because his father-in-law lost his money. But in the end of the day, the Maharal said, "No, I committed to this relationship. I'm going to go through the relationship." They waited for a while to see if the father-in-law could regain his business. It so happened that it didn't really work so well, and they ended up getting married regardless, before the business really took off. Perla actually tried helping the situation. She became a baker. She started to bake, and she also had her own issues, people stealing from her. But not only the food, but also, so there was some story, some legend with some kind of jacket that they had that was lined with gold, and that was their savings, and that was taken from them. So there's a whole story. Either way, they get married. They have 6 daughters and 1 son. The one son's name is Reb Bezalel, after his grandfather, and 6 daughters. Interestingly enough, sounds a lot like Rashi also, except besides the son part, right? Only daughters, mostly daughters. And what's also interesting about it, at least according to the Baal HaTanya, they say the Baal HaTanya said over that the Maharal used to learn with Perla. They used to learn together. The Baal HaTanya, apparently, I haven't seen this inside. I saw it quoted by a Chabad material. But they say the Baal HaTanya said that Perla never went a day without learning 5 hours of Torah. I don't know how that's possible with having 6 daughters and a son, but that's what she said. I'm not applying that threshold or that standard to anyone here, even for the men. I'm sure that's a very difficult thing to do, but especially if you got little kids and you're trying to take care of them, I'm not sure how that's possible. But legend has it that they did learn together, and that Perla actually was responsible for writing down many of the Maharal's Svarim, which come later in life, not even during the kids. So that makes a little more sense. But that she used to read out the Shilas, and the Maharal used to give the Tshuvas, and she used to write them down. That's what they say, at least, according to the Baal HaTanya. Ultimately, his first Shtela, his first job, seems to be 1553 in Nicholsburg. We mentioned that his brother was the rabbi there also, in 1553. So at this point, he's about 40 years old. He becomes the chief rabbi of Nicholsburg. He might have had another smaller job before that. And he stays there in Nicholsburg for 20 years. Notice that he's not the Rav in Prague, right? From the ages of 40 to 60, he's the Rav in relatively lesser known, but it's only lesser known because we know Prague. At the time, Prague was a small city. Prague was put on the map mostly because of the Maharal. But even that wasn't until later. Either way, so 1553, he becomes the Rav in Nicholsburg, and he creates somewhat of a following through his teaching, which we'll get to soon, his methodologies we'll talk about later. And ultimately, he gains such a following that for some reason, when he wants to go back to Prague, many of them follow him, meaning the students that he accumulates from his time as the chief rabbi in Nicholsburg. By the way, this Nicholsburg is the same as the Hasidish Nicholsburg. I don't know if people are familiar that there's a Nicholsburger Hasidus from Reb Shmelka of Nicholsburg, which doesn't actually take place for another 150, 200 years, but it's the same place. Anyways, so he ends up going to Prague, and these people follow him, And it just so happens that there's an election for who's going to become the next chief rabbi of Prague. So as you would expect, he would win, but you'd be wrong. Because your expectation is let down because the Maharal actually lost the chief rabbi position. Why did the Maharal lose the chief rabbi position? So some speculate it's because he gave a specific speech. Maybe the speech was indicative of a larger perspective that he had. And this had to do, believe it or not, with politics. Communal politics at the time, especially in Ashkenazic Jewry, was very much financially determined. If people had money, they could sort of buy their way into the rabbinate. If other people supported them had money, they could buy their favorite candidate into the rabbinate, and other things like that. So he apparently gives this speech. And in this speech, now this a lot of things might be conflated here. Different things happen at different times. Because he actually comes back to Prague. After he loses, he comes back to try out again. So unclear when things happened. But either way, he basically gives this speech. He says that people have to, you have to be more careful about eating yayin nesech, drinking yayin nesech, right? Drinking wine, which isn't properly cooked or properly handled by Jewish hands. And he was basically giving them mussar, that you can't do this. And that was a big thing for the wealthy businessmen, because the wealthy businessmen used to, talk it up with all the other wealthy businessmen. They would drink wine. And the second thing, which is probably also related to the abuse of power or of influence of certain people, he said that it's a big problem talking in shul. The Maharal was very big on outlawing talking in shul. Now, everybody's big on that. The question is whether or not you're going to do something about it. The Maharal did something about it. What did the Maharal do? The Maharal very innovatively created a Mishaberach. And this Mishaberach said, anyone who doesn't talk in shul is going to get this, this, and that bracha. And Hashem's going to bless you, and he's going to give you shefa, and he's going to give you parnasa, he's going to give you children. So anyone who talked in shul didn't get the bracha, right? That was his thought process. This Mishaberach is actually more well known for his student who actually published it, but it was the Maharal's idea. His student, Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, also known as the Tosfos Yom Tov, but either way, the Maharal came up with it first. This is how he tried to sort of influence when he was in Prague, when he was in other places, to create a more respectful Jewish community. So he loses the vote. He loses the vote, and he ends up going to, where did he go after he loses the vote? Now this is a little complicated because different people say he moved different times, but he ends up going to, unclear. I don't see where he does end up going. Maybe he went back to Nicholsburg, I'm not sure. But for the time being, let's talk a little bit about now that he's set up shop in Prague. He had a little bit of a following. He had a little bit of a yeshiva there. So let's talk a little bit about what his thoughts were, because the reason he set up the yeshiva was not because there weren't any yeshivas in Prague. There were plenty of rabbis in Prague and surrounding communities. He set up a yeshiva because he didn't like how the yeshiva was being run. He didn't like the curriculum. So this is interesting because we just talked about the other communal things he did for the adults, but he was also interested in the children. Because when he looked at the way that Torah was being learned, and this might sound familiar to you, he saw a lot of Gemara learning. Why are we teaching the kids Gemara when they're 10 years old? That's what he was saying. That the Mishnah in Avos tells us explicitly how you're supposed to do it. You're supposed to start with the basics, with Chumash, and then you go to Mishnah. And then you go, and then only after that, you do halacha, and only after that, you have to go upstairs, okay? Yeah. Only after that do you go to the Gemara. Nowadays, and what is the Mishnah says, when do you start to learn Gemara? If I were to ask you, based on yeshivas you've been to, or day schools you've been to, so you'd probably tell me, you start learning Gemara when you're in 5th grade, 6th grade, maybe if you're behind the ball, 7th grade. But the Mishnah says you don't learn Gemara until you're 15 years old. So the Maharal said, why aren't we learning the basics? Why are we skipping the stages? And the Maharal in his yeshiva reinstituted this as a curriculum. Not really sure if he even taught children, but this is what he preached. And in his yeshiva, he kept to the basics also. When he learned Gemara, when the Maharal learned Gemara, he said we have to focus less on Tosfos and more on Halacha. More on, first, what does Rashi say? And then, second, on what the Rush says and the Riff. He actually proposed, apparently, legend has it, he proposed that they switch what the Daf looks like. That instead of having Rashi and Tosfos, it should have the Riff and the Rush. So that you could understand the Halacha. Because people were just doing what they called pilpul, right? Which is what every yeshiva does nowadays, essentially, unless you're getting smicha. Every yeshiva does what's called pilpul. You look at Rashi, and you look at the Rashba, and you look at the Rambam, and you look at different things, and you try to compare and contrast, and none of it is necessarily towards any halacha, necessarily, but it's really to just get to delve into the Yam HaTalmud, right? To delve into the understanding of the Gemara, and how to understand what Chazal was saying. He was much more basic. When it comes to Gemara, you should be learning al pi halacha to understand what the Gemara was trying to teach you. He said no Gemara at early ages because that's sort of an abuse of the system. He also helped set up a Chevra Kadisha system, which was somewhat of a novel concept for apparently that community. Which I think he's still in Prague, according to what I have here. I thought he moved, but I guess not. Either way, those are some of the things he did. And he only started writing, meaning we think of the Maharal, we think of a lot of the books that he wrote, which we'll get to soon, but he only actually started writing in 1578. If he started writing in 1578, how old was he? He was born in 1512. That means he was 66 years old when he started writing. Interestingly enough, that's only after he stops being the chief rabbi. Maybe while he was a chief rabbi, he was too busy. He moves back to Prague, he gets a little yeshiva, he gets some students, but he's not really busy because he lost the job. He didn't get the job in Prague, and therefore, he had a little more time on his hands, he starts to write. What's the first book that he writes? As an emphasis to understanding not only Chumash, but also Chazal's understanding of Chumash, he writes a book called the Gor Aryeh. Gor Aryeh is from a pasuk in Bereishis, which is the bracha given to Yehuda. His name is Yehuda. His name is Yehuda Leib. And actually, Lowi also means a lion. So he names his book after the bracha of Yehuda, and also means lion. And he was a lion. So it's a commentary. So the way that he structures it, very interesting. And we'll read from it in a second on this week's Parsha. Well, not in a second, in a little bit. But he reads, he comments on Rashi. He doesn't comment on the Chumash. He's not a commentary on Chumash as much as he is a commentary on Rashi. Rashi, although Rashi himself says otherwise, Rashi is essentially a compilation of the main interpretations of Chazal, of the Gemara or the Midrash, in how to understand the Pasuk. And for the Maharal, he lived his life, and this factors into everything he does. He lived his life trying to understand and give over the authenticity of the Mesorah of Chazal, that he wanted the Torah to be understood the way that Chazal wanted it to be understood. That it wasn't about coming up with new things, but it was about understanding properly what Chazal were saying. So when Rashi quotes a Gemara, or Rashi quotes a Midrash to understand a certain pasuk or a certain story in the Parsha, so he's always there to explain it even further. And we'll see, he explains even the halachic aspects of Torah in the same way, which we'll get to soon. So that's the Gor Aryeh. And then he continues, he focused on what it meant, you know, later on in life, he not only writes about Torah, but also starts talking about philosophy. And this philosophy, I don't mean like Aristotle, although he was apparently influenced by Aristotle / the Rambam, which was basically the same thing. But really what I mean is machshava, right? Thinking about what is the Jew's place in the world, what is the purpose of the world, what is the role of the Jewish people vis-a-vis the non-Jewish people, what does it mean to have Mashiach, what does it mean Olam Haba, Olam Haza. He talks about all these very deep and grandiose ideas, and he tackles them in a way that interweaves the statements of Chazal and statements of the Torah and things like that. And what's interesting is that this sort of philosophy or this intellectual aspect of himself not only had an influence in the Jewish community, but actually gained him some renown in the non-Jewish community too. And apparently, he was friendly with the local who was it? Emperor Rudolf II. He used to go to Rudolf II and speak to him about alchemy and about philosophy. They say he also did a lot of mathematics. People knew about his prestige even in the non-Jewish corners of the community. I'm trying to read what I wrote here. All right, it was interesting because at that time, as we had mentioned a couple times already, there might have been a general, you know, a general tolerance for Jews at the time, but there were smaller events that were particularly difficult for the Jews, and the Maharal's prominence and his sort of his legend grew, and it actually helped the Jews. And we'll talk about that later when we get to the Golem, which everyone wants to talk about. Unfortunately, we'll talk about that soon. So either way, he wasn't afraid of disagreeing even with the Rishonim. It's kind of interesting because the Maharal comes at a time in the 16th century where there's really a transition of sorts, not only in terms of the fact that we're going from Rishonim to Achronim, but there's a transition in the focus. So there's I don't know if this is my own take, it's probably on my own opinion of it, but in the 16th century, what you have is basically a transition from sort of the codification of law into sort of the delving into law. So the Rishonim talked about the Gemaras, right? You have people like the Rambam, the Rif, the Rush, you have the Rashba, you have the Ran, the Ramban, the Ritva, right? The Maharam, Yerenberg, you have all these very big names in terms of commentaries. And then you have Rabbi Yosef Karo, who basically creates the Shulchan Aruch. You have Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who creates his own Shulchan Aruch. You have Rabbi Mordechai Yaffe, who writes the Levush. Everyone's writing sort of, the end of the line. This is the psak. This is the end of the end of the road. We have all our commentaries, and this is the conclusion. Okay, Shulchan Aruch, case closed, book closed. Now you have a new sort of wave, of sort of different emphases that come up. So you do have a little bit later. You have commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, like the Magen Avraham and the Taz and the Bach. Right, you have that segment also. Which is around this time too. But then you have like these other interesting, nuanced, areas of thought. So you have the Maharal who's going into Machshava. And then in Israel, you have the community of Tzvat is opening up. You have the Arizal in the 16th century who's sort of opening up the vistas of Kabbalah. And you have his students, the Rav Moshe Cordovero. And you have Rav Yosef Karo was even part of that transition. So you have interesting new areas of Torah learning which are developing, and the Maharal is sort of the one to really put Machshava on the map. He's the one that sort of brings forth this kind of philosophy, of a focus of philosophy. The Rambam did it, but he was sort of an outlier, and even the people after the Rambam saw the Rambam's works of philosophy as almost heretical, which is why, Rabbeinu Yonah or Shlomo Min Hahara, which as we talked about last year, so it actually burned the Rambam's books because as in the words of Rav Shlomo Minahar, Judaism is a religion of deed, not creed. We don't focus on all the philosophy stuff. We focus on what you're supposed to do practically. Either way, the Maharal reinvents that whole sort of genre of Jewish philosophy, and it wasn't really appreciated at his time either. Either way, back to his life for a second. In 1583. He's invited back to become the chief rabbi of Prague again. And in 1583, Rabbi Malkin passes away, the previous chief rabbi, and he comes to speak, and he spoke out against Kavod, and long story short, they hire somebody else, the Maharetz Chias. The Maharetz Chias is a different character, not for now, but he happens to be Pearl's stepbrother, right? So the Maharal's brother-in-law, or stepbrother-in-law. I don't exactly know the family dynamics there, but either way, what ultimately happens is the Maharal's chias takes over, and he couldn't take it. The Maharal moved back to Posen at the time, right? You know, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you, and he's out of there, right? So he goes away. He goes to Posen, and back to Posen in Poland. And the Maharal's chias is trying to be the chief rabbi, but as the Maharal's chias realizes, it's not so easy, right? The Maharal who the corruption of power in Prague, whatever it got to the Maharal's chias, and he comes back to his brother-in-law, the Maharal, and says, "Hey, you got to come help me out." So he wasn't necessarily elected as the chief rabbi, but he became the de facto chief rabbi of Prague. So what you find is that even though the Maharal really never made it in Prague, he ends his life in Prague, and that's why he's known as the Maharal in Prague. We'll see a couple other things that bring him into prominence for Prague also. But either way, he never took the official title of chief rabbi, but he, because his brother-in-law was still technically the chief rabbi, but he was the de facto chief rabbi. In 1589, he writes another sefer, as opposed to Gori Aryeh, he writes another sefer on Pirkei Avos, called Derech Chaim. I think it's called Derech Chaim, and which weaves not only human nature, obviously, but a lot of mysticism and his philosophies into it. As we said before, this is when he also, in 1592, is when he meets with the Emperor Rudolf II, and for some reason, he goes back to Posen for a little bit, right? A lot of murky stuff with the Maharal and where he goes, but he ends up coming back to Prague, and he writes in the Sivas Olam, which is about Musar and building yourself up. In 1596, he becomes the official chief rabbi of Prague, but he's basically too old to do any of the stuff that he said earlier, so he still has his philosophy, he still has his concept of education, and he has the Chevra Kadisha, right? He has all these things that he's already created, but he basically, he comes back to Prague in 1596, when he's already 84 years old, and he's officially the chief rabbi. Okay, and and he tries to get his son to become the chief rabbi, but it didn't really take, and his son goes somewhere else. His son actually passes away before him in 1600. And in 1604, he resigns as the chief rabbi. And in 1609, the Maharal passes away. Only a couple months later, we talked about Pearl. His wife Pearl passes away a few months afterwards. And that's why if you go to Prague, even today, and you go to the cemetery there, you'll see that there's a double tombstone. She passed away so soon afterwards that they actually share a tombstone. They're buried right next to each other. They produced it at the same time, and they are buried together. That is the Maharal's life in a nutshell. Obviously, a lot more to talk about. But let's talk a little bit about of his legacy. So we talked about his educational reform. We talked about his Chevra Kadisha aspect. He talked about speaking out against people talking in shul. We talked about how he was opposed to the kavod and the corruption in the community. But he also, perhaps as we said before, his greatest accomplishment or his greatest contribution, I should say, was his philosophy. Right? Well, not his focus on philosophy, his focus on machshava, or really his machshava to understand Chazal. And this concept, or this fusion of machshava within Chazal, is something that really wasn't appreciated. It wasn't something people were used to. As we said, he was somewhat of a, somewhat against the trends, and he was in many ways years, light years before his time. Because it's only really with the, with sort of the mainstreaming of Kabbalah, which could have happened with Shabtai Tzvi, but really more prominently happens with the Musar movement and with Hasidus 150 years later, in the 1750s, 1800, that his ideas were really picked up again. The Baal HaTanya apparently says, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe Shneur Zalman of Liadi apparently says, or apparently is known, The Mesorah is, he doesn't say this explicitly, the Mesorah is, if you look at the introductory page of the Baal HaTanya, which itself is obviously a formidable work of Hasidus, sort of the basis of a lot of Lubavitch thought. So he says there that his thoughts are based on books and scholars. And the Mesorah in Chabad, apparently, I'm not anyone to claim any expertise in Chabad. Maybe other people here are. But the Mesorah is that the Baal HaTanya was referencing the Maharal. He never references him explicitly in the Tanya, but apparently that's what Chabad believes, that the Tanya is based a lot on the philosophy of the Maharal and how the world, the dynamics of sort of the spiritual world are infused in the physical world and things like that. I'm in no way any expert, so I can't really tell you the ins and outs of it. But what is interesting is that it was taken up not only in Hasidic movements, but also in the Musar movement, which in many ways was a sort of like a counter movement to the Hasidic movement, meaning that in the response to the Enlightenment, there were a few different, in the 1700s and 1800s, there were a few different new areas of emphasis in Jewish study, in Jewish scholarship. You had on the one hand Hasidus, which we just mentioned. You had on the other hand, you had Volozhin, which we talked about last time. I think that was last time. Rav Chaim of Volozhin, or maybe that was 2 times ago. And then now you also have the Musar movement of Rav Yisrael Salanter. The movement of Volozhin didn't really take much of the Maharal. That was more about learning better. But when it comes to Hasidus and the Musar movement, so they borrowed concepts and ideas from the Maharal, which had basically they sort of resurrected. No one was really learning them. I mean, obviously, it was the Maharal. No one was like throwing them away, but they didn't become the emphasis or the central point of any movement. And in this case, for Hasidus and for the Musar movement, he really infuses and influences the creation of two movements which have endured until today. And the Musar movement basically became mainstream, but Hasidism is obviously it's an entire section of the Jewish people now. But people like Rav Yisrael Salanter and later on Rav Dessler and Rav more recently Rav Huttner are sort of the intellectual Balei HaMesorah of the Maharal. Right, you think about Rav Dessler, he quotes the Maharal all the time. You think about Rav Huttner is basically Maharal with different ideas, and these are considered the sort of the figures that carried the torch for the Maharal's legacy. But interestingly enough, no one was carrying that torch for 150 years. The Maharal passes away in 1609, and it's not until the late 1700s that anyone picks up on his ideas to the extent that they're going to do anything with them. So it's very interesting how that happens. Very interesting. A similar thing happened, if you remember, I think we talked about last year also, the Ramchal, who was passed over during this time also. There was a lot of pushback on the Ramchal's ideas, which themselves were Kabbalistically infused, philosophically, philosophically engineered in some ways. So it's interesting how sort of Jewish, and that could be because of Shabtai Tzvi, it could be because of Chmelnitsky, it could be a lot of things that caused that sort of, you know, the glossing over of these rabbis. But either way, the Maharal's legacy really has become, in the last 150 years, has become much more prominent because of these movements, where if it wasn't for these movements, he would probably be a footnote like other rabbis of the time. As we said before, as Rabbi Weinreb had mentioned, that his brothers, when he was alive, were more famous than he was, right? It's only later on that we have his books and we have these movements that develop based on his ideas that we actually know more about him. So you'll notice that I left out perhaps the greatest, legend about the Maharal. So why did I do that? Why did I leave it out? We just finished his whole life and I never mentioned the most famous aspect of his life, which was the Golem. Now, obviously, there's a very good reason for that. Here you have a book or sort of a halacha catalog people might be familiar with from the RCA called Tradition. Now, this is in some ways available online. I'm not really sure if other people can access it, or maybe it's just because I'm part of the RCA. I don't know. I think I've been able to access it before I was part of the RCA. But either way, in here, this is the volume 36, number 1 edition of the spring of 2002. And here you see, right here, what does it say? The Adventures of the Maharal in Prague, in London. Whatever that means. Reb Yudel Rosenberg and the Golem of Prague. So if you open this up, this is by Rabbi Dr. Schneer Lyman. I know people are familiar with Dr. Schneer Lyman, somewhat of a well-known Jewish historian. And in here, he goes through, where does this story come from? Because if you look through all of the stories of the Maharal, you look through all of the ideas or the books of the Maharal, he never talks about ever doing such a thing. Never mentions doing anything with a golem. So the question is, what's the deal? So it could be, and if you, I looked up on, I saw on Chabad's website, they have a post here, 10 facts about the Maharal every Jew should know. That's what it says. That's the name of the article. And in one of them, the point number 3 is, he believed a golem was nothing special. That's what it says on the Chabad website. I'm not really sure where they get this from, but he says that apparently, based on the Gemara, hold on, there's a source here. Right, well, the Maharal talks about golems in one of his books, Ber HaGola, but he talks about what the Tanaim did in the times of the Gemara, in times of the Mishnah, that there's a story that the Gemara tells us that they used to make out of the dust, they used to make a calf on Erev Shabbos for the sake of Shabbos, and there's a whole story there. And he felt that apparently, this is just a quote from this website here, the Maharal felt that using Sefer Yetzirah, which contains the divine names through which God created the world, was as simple as prayer. It's that easy. Although the Maharal acknowledged that this was not the natural way, he still felt that it was within the realm of this world. Whatever that means, I don't know. Can't tell you. But he never talks about his own personal experience with the golem. Not only does he never talk about it, but there's no contemporary evidence of it happening. Not only is there no contemporary evidence of it, there's no non-Jewish evidence of it, right? This part of the story is that this golem was wreaking havoc on all the non-Jews, right? He was protecting the Jews by fighting them off, by fighting off the enemy and stuff like that. Presumably that should be written down somewhere, right? We're not talking about biblical times. This is the 17th century. They know how to write things down. 16th century. We have things from that area, that era, and where there's no mention of such a monster of any kind that was able to fight off the enemy. So what's the deal? Where does this all come from? So the truth is that the first example of the golem in literature being associated with the Maharal is in 1837. 1837 is 220 years after the Maharal died. That's the first time we have any literature about the Maharal and the Golem of Prague. So the question is, where did they get it from? Yagu? So it's unclear where they got it from. But the reason that it's popular, and the reason that it became a thing, Ima wants you upstairs. Ima saying, Usher. All right, he's not going. The reason it became popular is because of a man named Reb Yudel. If you want to be here, you have to be quiet, okay? Reb Yudel Rosenberg. That's his name. Reb Yudel Rosenberg was a rabbi in the 19th century. And towards the beginning of the 19th century, Reb Yudel Rosenberg writes like a storybook. And in the storybook, he tells a couple stories. The first story that one of the first stories he tells is something called Choshen HaMishpat Shel HaKohen Gadol. This is the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. And in that story, he talks about sort of the stones of the breastplate. And in that story, it's a whole thing where the stones were stolen from a museum in London. And then the Maharal was the one who went and somehow through a whole complicated web of interactions, he's able to get the stones back. And he brings them back to Prague. That's the story. The only problem is, it is almost word for word taken from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's story about the Jewish priest's breastplate. So very interestingly, so Dr. Lyman sort of goes through, well, how did this happen? On the one hand, Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg claims that this is a story which was sourced from the Prague, right? He says that there's a manuscript from Prague that he saw, etc. The only problem is Sir Arthur Conan Doyle didn't speak Hebrew. He didn't know the language. So there's no way that Doyle took it from Prague. Most possibly is that Rosenberg took it from Doyle, which is presumably what happened. And therefore, that throws into question the story of the golem too. So Lyman goes through the story of the golem, which, by the way, is a very long, it's a whole book, Niflos HaMaharal. And in that book, it talks all about the different things the Maharal does. We know the general story because it's very simple. He creates the Frankenstein or the monster, and then the monster fights off the bad guys, and then he's getting too powerful, and then he takes away the power from it, and then he dies. And then he's stored up in the attic of the Altnoy Shul, which, by the way, can't be true because they've done renovations on the Altnoy Shul and there was no golem to be found. But either way, it's a fun thing to point at the door and say you can't go in there because there's a golem there. Either way, says Schneer Lyman over here, the odds are that this is also made up. First of all, because almost all of the details don't make any sense. It talks about the Emperor Rudolf II, but it claims that the story happens in 1572 with the golem. But he didn't even, the Emperor Rudolf wasn't an emperor until 1592. So it's not possible that he had interaction in that way. There are other things that don't make sense. The Cardinal Johann Sylvester, the dates are wrong for him also. He says here, in that year, Maximilian II served in both capacities as emperor and king of Bohemia. The Maharal was granted private audience with the Rudolf II, but it only happened in 1592. Alas, not only did no cardinal by the name of Johann Sylvester serve in Prague during the lifetime of the Maharal, but no cardinal by that name seems to have served at any time in Prague or anywhere else. So he says, clearly, the Niflos Maharal was not written by the Maharal's son-in-law. It appears to be a literary hoax, and like all other alleged manuscripts from the Royal Library in Mentz, it was modern forgery published by Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg. This is Schneer Lyman making this claim. So, what actually happened? Why did Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg write this? So he has a very interesting piece here, and it's called In Defense of Rabbi Yudel. That's what he says here. We'll get to that in a second. There happens to be another interesting historical fact, almost contemporary, not really contemporary, which gets mixed up with this concept, because Rav Yaakov Emden, now hold on for a second, I know Rav Yaakov Emden is the late 18th century, so how could you ever be quoting Rav Yaakov Emden in the context of the Maharal? Rav Yaakov Emden's father, the Chacham Tzvi, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Ashkenazi, I think that was his name, he in his tshuvas talks about how there was someone he knew that made a golem. And the name that he uses is the same name as one of the students of the Maharal. So some people like to say, oh, that's where it got all mixed up. But that can't be, because the Chacham Tzvi lived in the 1700s, and the Maharal lived in the 1500s. They just happened to have the same name, and they just happened to be, maybe somebody conflated them, maybe someone got confused. No, it can't be. It just doesn't make any sense. For the timing doesn't work out. What the historicity of that story is, we don't know. It happens to be a very interesting tshuva, by the way. I think I talked about it once. I talked about it once in terms of Minyan. I think you talked about it in terms of Minyan on Parshas Vayigash. We talked about Minyan and needing 10 men, and can you use a child? Can you do the Sefer Torah thing? The whole tricks. We talked all about that. I think in that year we talked about this tshuva. Because in the tshuva he wrote, the Chacham Tzvi addressed the question, can you... Rav Yaakov Emden actually is quoting his father, if I'm not mistaken. Rav Yaakov Emden wrote the tshuva, but it's in the Shalos Tshuvas Chacham Tzvi. I don't remember exactly. Either way, Rav Yaakov Emden has a whole piece there about what happened. And he says, the question was, can you use a golem and a minion? That was the question. And it quotes the Gemaras where Rav Huna actually killed the golem, and therefore if they killed the golem, must not be a legitimate person. And if it's not a legitimate person, you can't use him for a minion, a whole thing. But that's the tshuva that points to the fact that there was a golem created in the 7th or 18th century. And that's why some people get confused that was the same golem that the Maharal made. It was really the student that was named, whatever. It doesn't make any sense because the timing doesn't work and we don't even know about that story itself. In the end of the day, the story of the golem never happened. Never happened, unfortunately. There's no evidence of it ever happening, and there is very, very little, even what to hold on to, that it's even possible that it could have happened, based on the fact that no one ever talks about it. Not the Maharal, not the colleagues of the Maharal, not the constituents of his congregation, not his son, not his sons-in-law, not the general population. There's no reference to it. The only reference to it is 220 years later in some Jewish magazine. Someone just said it. And then Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg runs away with it and makes this whole thing out of it. Why did Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg write this? So this is where really, for me, it gets interesting. The fact that the Golem didn't happen, I'm not shocked, okay? But Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg somehow, I don't know, Dr. Schneer Lyman somehow got a hold of an invitation to a banquet. A banquet that took place on February 18th, 1931 in the Jewish community of Montreal, and it was a celebration of Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg's 70th birthday. Okay, I'm just going to read this to you. A souvenir journal was published and distributed at the banquet in his honor. It includes a detailed biography in Yiddish that could only have been written by or with the aid of Rabbi Yudel. Right? So Rabbi Yudel is writing the journal for himself, as many speakers' biographies are. In it, Rabbi Yudel's literary au revoir, is that how you pronounce that? O-E-U-V-R-E? I don't know how to pronounce that. Is subdivided into three categories. There are three categories. What is it?
It's Oeuvre.
Oh. Okay. I still don't think I can pronounce it. Either way. So, subdivided into three categories, meaning his biography is three parts to it. Number one, or the works of the books that he made. Number one is Rabbinische Svarim. Number two is Drush und Kabbalah Svarim. Right? So he's writing rabbinic stuff, maybe halachic stuff, and then he's writing Kabbalah stuff. And then number three is something which is called Folks Literature, meaning folk tales. And it says listed prominently in the category of folks literature are Niflos HaMaharal and Choshen HaMishpat. Right, this is Schneer Lyman reading an invitation or a journal from this banquet in 1931. Clearly, Reb Yudel did not attempt to misrepresent the fictional character of either book. Much like his older contemporary, Marcus Lehmann of Mainz, Reb Yudel wrote historical novels and short stories for the masses. These were intended to inculcate Jewish values, provide Jewish heroes for juveniles, meaning kids, and offer a religiously acceptable alternative to the proliferation of German and French novels at the turn of the century. Many mistook his fiction for fact, and that can't be blamed on Reb Yudel Rosenberg. This is what Schneer Lyman points out. It might be true that it's fiction, but he wasn't trying to pretend like it was fact. It was a tall tale to give over a certain value system, to give over a certain sort of perspective of what the Maharal meant to the Jewish people at that time in Prague. The Maharal was looked at as the protector of the Jewish people. Did he actually create a golem? No, but he protected the Jews. He served as a leader for the Jews. He was influential for the community. And that's why Reb Yudel Rosenberg created that story, in order to sort of give over that message, give over that perspective. Nowadays, as Shlomo Carlebach likes to say, people don't tell stories anymore. People don't understand the value of a good fictional story. They think everything is either has to be exactly true, or it's either fake news and we can't believe it. But there's a value in giving over an inspirational story that people can be inspired by, people can understand sort of the essence of a person by. Even if it's not literally true, there is something of worth in a fictional story. That's what Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg meant to do. Unfortunately, either because the city of Prague fell in love with the idea, or because Jewish people need that sort of inspirational true story, so then it became this folklore that everybody bought into. And now if you go to Prague, you'll see a statue of the Maharal and you'll see a statue of the Golem, and the touristy sites will all sell little Golem keychains. You can get the whole Golem thing and you can pretend like it's true, but the truth is it was a folk tale in order to bring attention to the hero of the Maharal, not the heroes of the French and German secularists at the time. That's why Reb Yudel Rosenberg created the story. Nothing to do with an actual story. It's really a double-edged sword. It's really it's really bittersweet. On the one hand, this story has brought certain prominence to the Maharal, and it's brought certain attention to sort of Jewish intellectualism. On the other hand, it's taken the focus of who the Maharal was away from his unbelievable influence and his contribution in terms of machshava, his contribution in terms of curriculum, and in terms of how to run a community, and it's put it on this random thing that never even happened. It might be representative of the types of things the Maharal did or he cared about, but in general, the lasting legacy of the Maharal shouldn't be some crazy story about a golem, but it should rather be about his contributions into machshava, into philosophy, into understanding Chazal. And I just realized we have 5 minutes left, and I have to actually teach you something from the Maharal. So here's a quick idea on this week's Parsha based on the Maharal and the Gor Aryeh. So we know the Pasuk tells us this week's Parsha. The Pasuk says, V'hayayim ben hakos harasha v'yipil ha'shofi v'yikilon av l'fanav. Okay, down, go. A person who is warned and knows what he's doing wrong ultimately is obligated lashes. So the Pasuk says, Arbayim yakenu lo yosif. You should give the person 40 lashes, but no more than that. However, Chazal explained that 40 really means 39, just like in Shabbos, 39 melachos. So asks the Maharal what everybody asks. Well, if it's 39, so just say 39. If it's 40, so then why don't we do 40? Why does the Pasuk say 40, but it's really 39? So the Maharal says in the Gor Aryeh, on his commentary on Rashi, this week's Parsha, the end of the parsha. So he says like this, I'll have to skip the other opinions. He says, Nire, ki bevadai hayara'oi lilkos arbaim keneged arbaim yom shal yitzias havlad. 40 lashes is sort of a representation of the creation of a human being. When you get lashes, when you're getting atonement, you're recreating yourself, right? Also nogeya, also relevant for Rosh Hashanah, right? We're reinventing ourselves on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. We're becoming new people. And therefore, the 40 lashes that you give to a person are themselves indicative of the 40 days of the creation of an embryo. Right? That's how we look at it in halachic terms. The embryo becomes significant after 40 days. Ubiyom ha'acharon. And on the last day, what happens on the 40th day of that creation of an embryo? It's according to the Maharal. Mekabel havlad neshama. That's when the embryo gets his neshama. How does that work in terms of being inside the still an embryo in utero? I don't exactly know. Ubechol lamites hu brias haguf. The first 39 days are when the body is created, and on the 40th day is when the vlad is when that embryo gets his neshama, his or her neshama. Says the Maharal, what do you understand from that? The guf is 39, and the neshama is the 40th. What sins when it comes to a person, when they make a bad decision, what is the problem? What's the area of deficiency? It's always with the guf. Ubeguf hu achet, shebo hayetzer hara. The person's inclinations to do the wrong things are all their physical body. The neshama wants to do the right thing. However, haneshama chata imo. The soul is still there. The neshama is with the body. Shekol hamechubar latame harehu kamahu. Anything which is connected to the tuma, to the impurity, is itself sort of an accomplice to that impurity. Shekol hamechubar latame harehu kamahu ba'oda im haguf, while it's still with the body. Ulefikach amra Torah. Therefore, the Torah says, arba'im yakenu, 40 lashes, because af haneshama she'im haguf chayev hamalkus. Even the neshama is required to gain atonement. Im haguf chayev hamalkus. Shekol asher haneshama im haguf shehu achote harehi kamahu. As long as the neshama is with the body, the soul is with the body, so it's an accomplice to the same issue that the body had. So therefore, 40 lashes for the 39 lashes for the creation of the body, and then the 40 for the neshama. Achein. Says the Maharal, Kishemakin osolamates makos. When you hit a person 39 times, Shekein amruchacham kochayel makos nitru midayon shenal de makos. So he says, "Ubezeh shav yitziras haguf naki min hachet." What happens after 39? 39 represents the body. So you've given the 39 lashes, and all of a sudden, the body has gained its atonement. Right? All the lashes that you've given thus far have now created atonement for the body. V'harei b'lamentes makos husar hachet min haguf. Therefore, there's no longer any necessity for the body to get absolution, right? The body is now pure again after 39 lashes. Umemela nimsa haneshama tahora, and thereby the neshama is also pure. The only reason the neshama was impure was because it was lugged along, it was schlepped along with the body. But now the body is pure again. So if the body is pure, the neshama is no longer schlepped along with it. The neshama is now pure again. She'ein ba p'chisos ba'atzma, there's no deficiency in the neshama himself. Rak kasher hi mitzurefes l'guf hachote, it's only when it's connected to the body. Kasher guf naki merachet, when the body no longer has that impurity. Ein kam p'chisos b'chet b'neshama, there's no deficiency or lacking or chet, any sin with the neshama. V'ein sarach l'halkoso od. So which one is it? 39 or 40? Says the Maharal, it's really 40. But once you do the 39, there's no need for the 40th. Because by that point, the entire body is clean already. That it really is, when you do the 39, you cleanse the 40th already. And therefore, arbarim yakenu, which is in relation to the creation of an embryo. But in the end of the day, you only have to do the 39, because that last one is in the neshama. And that neshama, which is the clinching process of the creation of the person, is also naturally going to be finished off, is going to be clean once the body is clean. Really an unbelievable, you can just see sort of an example out of that Maharal, how the Maharal thinks. You take something which is seemingly so, either aggressive or, one of these laws you find in Judaism, very technical, very mechanical, and then he brings within it some kind of unbelievable philosophy that talks about the creation of a man and how that influences or how that informs the halacha, and you get a little glimpse of who the Maharal was and what his contributions were to understanding not only the Torah but also Chazal and what it means for the influence, the contribution he's made not only to in his own books but also to the movements that we have in terms of Chassidus and in terms of Musar. You can see a little bit of that in this idea. So hopefully that's a little bit of a glimpse into the story, into the biography of the Maharal. That's a glimpse, hopefully a not too sad of a bursted bubble about the Maharal and the Golem. And then there's a little bit of Torah from the Maharal so that you understand who he was and the type of philosophy, the type of machshava we're talking about when the Maharal is brought up. He happens also to have an interesting influence over Rav Shimshon Farel Hirsch also. So he really has a lot of different contributions that go way beyond just his life. And I'm glad we were able to learn from him so that we can understand who he was. Whenever he comes up again, you have a greater appreciation for what he did and what he accomplished. Okay, we're a little over time, but hopefully you gain from that and you understand a little bit better about his life. Okay, Shkayach.